Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back on the program once again Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is here once a month. It's always on a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance. And so this is your opportunity to ask a question. If you got a problem, you're not quite sure how to solve it, give us a call, tell us about it, and Scott will do his best to help you out. We have somebody ready to go already, but let me give you the phone number for those of you who want to call in, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you got questions, give us a call. Thanks very much for being here.
Good morning, David.
We appreciate it. Well, we'll start right off here. We have callers. We will not make them wait. Starting in with line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
We're about to do some more maintenance on our house this summer, and part of that includes replacing our front porch flooring. We have a bid from a local contractor, which proposed, looking at it here, tongue and groove fir porch flooring. But we wanted to have a very low maintenance or no maintenance at all for porch flooring. And so he looked a little bit further, and he came up with a product called Aeritas, which is a PVC organic and inorganic flooring. Have you heard of that, and can you...
Okay, I don't necessarily know that particular brand name, but I have seen several of the basically recycled milk jug type planking systems, and they are a pretty good low maintenance. So far, I haven't seen any real big downfalls on them, particularly on a porch floor where they get a little bit of UV protection. It will last longer in the fir. The tongue and groove fir is a very nice looking porch, but as you indicated, it's not quite as low maintenance. It does require painting, and once you do some painting to it, then it shows foot traffic and wear and such. But at the moment, yes, the recycled plastic decking does seem to be a pretty good alternative. Generally, it's a little bit more expensive than the wood would be, the fir, but it does seem to have a pretty good...
$2,000 in our case.
Yeah, but it does seem to be a pretty good alternative. I've seen it on several different construction sites. It hasn't been around long enough for us to really have a proven track record, so I can't say, hey, that stuff's great and never seen a problem with it, because it really hasn't been out there long enough to say whether or not the problems are going to start showing up yet.
Okay, I'm looking at some specifications for it, but probably it would not be appropriate to read them over the air. Thank you.
All certainly. Right.
Well, let's go to line number two on the next caller. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, my question has to do with the submersible sump pumps.
Uh-huh.
And I'm always concerned about having a lot of water coming in and the sump pump giving up. And I just wanted to, is there some guidelines or recommendations regarding when to replace sump pumps to avoid catastrophes where they just give out?
Well, no, not really. It's one of those things where they really don't have a finite life. Oftentimes we can do things to help them make them last a little bit longer, such as make sure that the sump is large enough that the pump doesn't just shut on and off almost instantly. You know, if you get them in a real small bucket, they only run for a few seconds and turn back off, and it tends to wear out the switches. But, yeah, there's no good indicator, unless it starts making some noises or doing something like that where it starts – not pumping water, it really doesn't give you an indication when it's going to go out. And I've seen them last anywhere from, 3 years to 30 years. So it's really, really kind of a difficult one to pick.
Yeah. Is that dependent on the brand? Like, I understand Zoeller's probably top of the line.
Well, there's several very good brands which are usually available from the plumbers and not necessarily through the do-it-yourself stores. But the ones at the do-it-yourself stores, the Wayne's and things like that, they seem to have a pretty good life as well. There are a couple different ways you can do some backup systems. So if you have a primary system, you can always look into either a water-powered backup system, which works as a siphon system if you've got a good water system. Here in Champaign-Urbana, we've got fantastic water pressure. It lasts pretty much any time, so that works quite well. There's also 12-volt battery backup systems. And if you've got a system that only comes on once in a while, they do make units where you can put an alarm on your sump pump so that if it gets up too high, it starts putting out a beeping noise so that you know that the pump is out before you end up with actual flooding.
Yeah.
Okay. But, yeah, unfortunately, on a sump pump, there's no good way of saying, okay, well, this is going to go out in the next couple of weeks or next couple of months, so I need to get a new one. And it's just no good indicators.
Okay, very good. Okay, thanks, Scott.
All right, very good. On to another caller here. This is Champagne and someone on line three. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have a house that was built in 1941, and the original exterior window frames are still in place, the wooden frames. Now, some of these seem to have gotten some soft, spongy spots in them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I think my dad used to call them dry rot, but it's wet.
Right.
I was wondering what you would recommend. I hesitate to take out the whole entire frame. I was wondering if you think it might be better just to cut out the affected spot and try to put wood putty in there, or... Well, what would you recommend?
Well, the wood putty, or even I've seen repaired with silicone, they're kind of a short-term or a gap-type repair. Ideally, if you've got rotted wood, what we need to do is figure out, A, why is there water getting to it that causes it to rot,
mm-hmm.
and, B, get it out of there and cut it out and replace it, because any rotted wood will tend to be food for mold, mildew, bugs, things like that. Most windowsills are... that get damage to them, usually it's at the bottom of the returns or the sides on the outside or on the sill itself. Sometimes it can be caused by an aluminum storm window that's sealed and not allowing water to drain out from underneath it, so it sits on top of the sill. Sometimes it's caused by an improperly installed aluminum cladding around the sill or around the window frame. Other times it's just a poor flashing around the window. So it's one of those things where you really need to determine, okay, why is this wood getting wet? Because ideally, the way the window is designed and the flashing around the window, we should not have water at the sill and on the bottoms of the frames.
Mm-hmm. I think in my case it has to do with the guttering.
Okay, dumping in a lot of extra water down there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. But do you think it would be better just to cut that section out instead of replacing the entire frame?
That's something that can be done. It kind of depends on your carpenter and how he wants to take a good whack at it. Sometimes taking the entire sill out is not all that difficult. It's not a matter of taking the entire window out or taking the whole window out of the frame or anything. Usually a sill can be taken out, and it's amazing how many pieces of wood around the window are actually more trim pieces than they are the actual frame of the window. So depending on where your rot is as to how significant the repair is going to need to be.
Yeah. Okay, well, I love having an old house, but it certainly keeps one busy.
Well, they're a lot of fun. They're a work of art. We get these nice classic old houses that I come across, and it's one of those things, if you get one that somebody let go for a while, yeah, it can be kind of difficult to bring back up. But once you get it back up into condition, the older wood windows seem to last as well as just about any of the replacement windows.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. Scott Spies is the guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do the show once a month on home maintenance, and if you have a question, call us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to sump pumps just for a second. Are sump pumps sized according to, say, the size of your house or how much water you think that they're going to have to carry, or are they pretty much all the same size and pumping capacity?
Well, there are a very wide variety of pumps, and yes, you do have to size them a little bit according to your need. You've got 1/3 horse and you've got half horse. You can go all the way up to 3/4 or 1 horse pumps.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you get up into a 1 horse pump and you've got way more pump than you should ever need. If you've got that much water coming in, we need to work on considering putting in a fire hydrant and using it for fighting fires, because the half horse pump, while it's a smaller pump, it'll handle probably any drainage you're going to get into your sump pump. Part of the question is, how high do I have to lift it? How far do I have to push the water? If it's in a really deep 10-foot basement or something, a half-horse pump may be a little on the light side, in that by the time we get enough head pressure to actually lift the water all the way up to the top and then back out, that pump is straining a little bit. So for something like that, I would recommend going to probably a 1/3 horse motor, or excuse me, the third horse would be the one that would be too mm-hmm. light. You go to the half horse and move up a little bit in size to try and make sure that we have enough pressure to get the water up and out. So, yes, there is some sizing to it, but for the most part, from what I see, the smaller pumps will work just fine for most areas, unless you've got really deep basements. Again, if you've got so much water coming in that the pump can't keep up, then obviously we'd want to put a bigger pump in, but we need to really figure out why we've got that much water coming in, because one of those pumps will pump a lot of water in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Usually they're 500 or 600 gallon per hour type pumps.
Wow. Okay. And what about the size of the hole that you're going to set it in? Because you said earlier, you know, you also have to make sure that that's not too small.
Yeah, I don't like to see a sump pump installed in a 5 gallon paint bucket or something. What happens is the pump takes up a fair amount of volume or space in that pump, in that sump. And so when the pump kicks on, the water level drops very quickly. So you end mm-hmm. up with the pump wanting to kick on and kick off on a regular basis. And one of the things that wears out an electric motor is the initial starting and stopping of the motor, because there's the armature is at a stop and we've got to add current to it, and usually there's a little bit of an arc or something across the armature, and so we can get some corrosion. So a pump that will, you know, run for a minute and a half to pump out a fairly large sump, as opposed to one that will run for 15 seconds or 20 seconds to pump out a fairly small pump, the one that runs a little bit more, a little longer, will probably last a little bit longer. So I like to see a sump pit. Usually they make a plastic tile that's fairly easy to get in this area. It's about 24 inches deep by about 20 inches in diameter. And by setting that all the way down in the ground, we not only have a source of where we can get water coming in, groundwater coming in, so we keep the soil underneath the house relatively dry, but we've got enough of a pit area that when we put the pump down there, we can set the float high enough. It gets halfway up, it kicks on, it pumps out 7 or 8 gallons of water instead of 2 or 3 quarts of water.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, people got questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is our monthly show on home maintenance, and the guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. I was just said just before we got going here that our house, we've been toughing it out here so far. We have not yet turned on the air conditioning in our house. I have the feeling this week is going to be it. But this morning, Mike Solo was talking about the fact that it's particularly, I think he was talking about Thursday, looks like we're going to have a high temperature, maybe around 90, and the humidity is going to be up. So I expect a lot of folks, if they're fortunate enough, they have central air, they haven't turned it on yet. My prediction, this week, this is the time that you're going to turn it on. So if you have not run your air conditioning yet, is there anything in particular you'd suggest to people to do just to make sure that it's ready to go?
Well, it's always a good idea when we have a seasonal change, which, like, again, a lot of people have already had their air conditioner running, to check the air filters. Mm-hmm. We need to check those probably every 3 months or 4 months or so. If you've got long-haired pets, a little bit more often. It's not a bad idea to take a walk around the outside of the house, go take a look at that compressor sitting out there. I just ran into one the other day that had so much overgrowth around it, mm-hmm. The vines and things like that. We've had enough rain. The plants and such are growing quite rapidly, particularly the weeds. And you get a little, you know, nobody really wants to see that compressor around the house, so they put some plants there. But you got to make sure that it gets enough room to get some airflow to it to help the efficiency of it. The other thing is to get take a look at it and see just how old it is. The newer ones have a fairly high SEER rating, or seasonal energy efficiency rating. This SEER rating is actually the number of BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. If you've got a unit that's, say, 15 or 17 years old, it may have a SEER rating of around 6 or 8, where nowadays I believe 13 is the least that you can buy. So if you were to replace a 6 SEER unit with a 13 SEER unit, you literally cut your fuel usage or energy consumption in half or better, because we're getting twice as many BTUs of cooling per watt of electricity. So you might want to consider putting in a new one, although the first day that it hits 90 is not probably the first prime opportunity to call up your serviceman and say, hey, I need a new air conditioner today.
Yeah.
So that's something you may want to look at in a little bit longer term. But yeah, cleaning the air filters and probably walking around the outside, checking the condenser, make sure we've got the growth out and away from it. And also, it's interesting enough, when you change from heating and cooling, one of the big things that will help the house is balancing the ductwork. Usually in your heating season, you need to have more warmth put on the north side of the house where you don't have as much solar gain. Also on the first floor because the heat tends to rise. And the opposite is true for cooling. For cooling, we really need to have most of our cool air put up high on the second floor, usually on the south side where the sun has started to warm things up. And by balancing the dampers, usually you've got some duct dampers that you can open and close to kind of control some of this airflow. You can do also with the registers themselves if you can find if you can't find the duct dampers. But by changing this airflow pattern around, you can actually make the house a little bit more comfortable to where you're not always bumping the thermostat up or down going, hey, this room is too cold. I've got the air conditioner turned down too low. You go to the next one and it's like, well, it's too hot, so I need to bump it back up. So by finding a good way of balancing out that ductwork, you can really help save yourself a little bit of energy and make the house more comfortable.
Yeah. And there's a kind of a trick. I know you've talked about it. Both you and your dad have talked about it. Seeing if you're system is operating the way that it should by what you need. You need two thermometers, or maybe you need one thermometer. You can do the two places, and you need to take a reading at where the cold air is coming out and then take a reading at the return where it's drawing the air back in and comparing those two temperatures.
The temperature drop, yes. The drop across the system. In central Illinois, an air conditioner is actually more important as a dehumidification system or as important as a dehumidification system as it is a cooling system. So we don't want to blow too much cold air. Too much cold air will cool the house down rapidly but will not move enough air to pass a condenser to actually help pull some of that moisture out of the house to make the house actually comfortable. So we like to see about a 10 to 12 degree drop across the system. So if your return air, if you've got your thermostat set at 76 degrees and your return air is going in the 76 to 78 range, you're probably only going to get about 66 to 68 degrees out at the supply. And some people say, oh, well, I want it really cold. And like I say, cold is not necessarily the most efficient. Moving a lot of cool air actually is more efficient than moving a little bit of cold air. So, yeah, you can check it on your own. Put the thermometer in the return air, get a good reading, and then move it over to the supply.
All right. We've got a couple of calls here. We'll go to next somebody on line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a question. You were mentioning humidity on your last call. And I had a question regarding I have a dehumidifier in my basement. And I'm wondering, and I also have a monitor that tells me what the humidity is in my basement. And I was wondering, at what humidity level should we try to keep our humidity at in our basement to prevent mold and mildew and stuff like that?
Well, the house likes to be as dry as possible. Too dry is when you walk in through the house in your socks and you reach out for the light switch and you get this big static zap between you and the light switch, or you reach out to pet the dog and he goes yelping the other direction because his hair is staying on end. And that's a little too dry. Too wet, of course, is water on the windows, which we usually see in the wintertime. In the summertime, running a dehumidification system, I really like to see the houses in the 55 to 65% range about tops. You're not going to have much luck getting it a lot drier than that in this area because we've just got so much moisture in the air outdoors. When you pull water out of your basement, you're reducing the vapor pressure, or you're pulling moisture out of there. And that vapor pressure, as it lowers and you're pulling more moisture out, it will actually move moisture from other parts of the house. So putting a dehumidifier anywhere will help dehumidify everywhere in the house. So you don't necessarily need to just put it in the basement, although that's usually one of the more convenient places. But you don't feel like you need to put it in the living space where you're at. You can put it into a laundry room over a top of a drain or something so you don't have to empty it all the time. And it will be just as effective at keeping the basement dry in that area because this vapor pressure will move moisture through floors, doors, walls, everything except vapor barriers such as plastic, glass, things like that. But yeah, I would say if I were going to set one, 65 is probably on the high side. 55 is probably optimum, 55 to 58, but you may have a hard time keeping that unless you run the air conditioner on a regular basis.
I see. Well, I know if I run my dehumidifier, I have to run it pretty constantly to get it down around 55. On the other hand, the basement naturally stays between 65 and 70 percent humidity. So
you're using a little bit of air conditioning then?
No, actually, I haven't turned my air on. And
oh,
I hope,
okay.
I hope not to. I'm just running a dehumidifier in the basement just to prevent the mold from showing up.
Yeah. Once you get up in the 65 and 70 range, you're getting a little on the humid side, and we get a really good humid day, a little rainy day that's relatively warm, and your humidity level in your basement can come up. What'll happen is the basement walls themselves will stay about 55 or 60 degrees because of the ground contact, and that will be the coldest spot in the house. And the coldest spot is where the moisture will start condensing first once we start getting our humidity level up in the house. So, yes, you will start seeing some condensation on the walls and stuff if you get much higher than that 70-72% range.
I see. All righty. Very good.
All right. Thanks. You know, I've heard you say this before about the fact that air moves all throughout the house, so moisture will also move all throughout the house. So that means that a dehumidifier placed anywhere in the house will have an effect on the whole house. And yet at the same time, I mean, I have sort of had some of the same issues as the caller. I run one in, at least during the summertime, I run one in my basement. It's just kind of damp, and it feels more damp there than any place else in the rest of the house. But what you're saying is, though, that in fact it has a whole, even if it's in the basement, it has a whole house effect.
Yes. Once the water evaporates, it becomes a water vapor, and vapor is moved by vapor pressure, not airflow. So you could actually be moving air in one direction, and you could have moisture moving in an opposite direction. Mm-hmm. The moisture will move towards the low pressure area or the low vapor pressure area. So if you've got a dehumidifier or an air conditioner while pulling moisture out of one space, then the higher vapor pressure or higher moisture levels will move towards those lower pressure areas. So it's one of those things where, yes, if you've got a dehumidifier running in the laundry room, as the vapor pressure lowers in the laundry room, the vapor pressure in the kids' bedroom upstairs will start moving down through floors, doors, walls, etc. Likewise, if you put a vaporizer in a child's room for colds and respiratory illnesses, 20 to 30 minutes after you shut that vaporizer off, the moisture in that room is now moving through the rest of the house despite closed doors, etc. Mm-hmm. It'll move through floors, carpets, walls. So this vapor pressure will try and equalize through the house. So that's why I say you can put that dehumidifier just about anywhere and have it come out. And as far as the basement feeling damp when you go down there, your body acts as a radiant heater. And as you walk downstairs and you stand next to that basement wall that is 55 or 60 degrees, you immediately start radiating heat towards it. So you walk into the basement's going to feel cooler, and that coolness usually does come with a kind of a damp feel. Mm-hmm. That's why I like to recommend, if you're going to finish your basement or use a basement on a regular basis, to put even a thin layer of insulation between the wall and yourself, some type of insulating board or drywall or something that can act as a barrier. So when you walk down there, you don't immediately start losing your body heat towards the wall saying, gosh, this basement's damp and cold. So just a little bit. I mean, it doesn't even take much. A half an inch of insulation on a basement wall would be amazing effect as to how livable or how much more comfortable that basement will be.
Okay. On again to another caller here. We have somebody line number two. And hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
This must be humidity and air conditioning day. So you were saying, just to make sure I got the point, because I was doing some other things. So you try to keep the humidity in the range of 55 to 60. Is that what you, right?
Yeah, I like to see it in the 55 to 60 to maybe even 65 if you're not running the air conditioner on a regular basis. But you start getting up above that 65, get up in the 70% range, and you've got a lot of humidity in the house. And so in the cooler areas, such as basements and crawl spaces and stuff, we can start getting some condensation.
Okay, and the other one is that in terms of what's the temperature, in other words, from the intake to the vents, in terms of the temperature, what kind of thing that you feel that it's working good? What should that be about, the difference?
Well, a little bit depends on the efficiency of the system. The higher efficiency systems usually actually have a little less temperature drop. In other words, they'll move, say, 10 or 11 degree colder air through the house, whereas an older one may be moving 13 or 14 degree cooler air through the house.
All right. And then finally, I don't really run the air conditioning that much. So, in other words, when you come home at night and you put it on, it should run for at least, 10 minutes, my understanding, to make sure that, because if it does sort of less than that initially, you're not getting the humidity out, right? Is that correct or not?
Well, yeah, by turning the air conditioner off for half the day and then coming home and turning it back on, you really don't give the air conditioner a chance to dry the house out, because what will happen is while it's off, the moisture levels from outdoors will permeate everything, carpets, furniture, walls. And so it will take the air conditioner hours, several hours literally, to help pull some of that moisture back out. Now, it will cool the house down, but a house that is cold and damp, or a cool and damp, is not necessarily as comfortable as one that's not quite as cool but dry. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where unless your house is shaded well and doesn't pick up a lot of solar gain, it may not be a bad idea to leave the air conditioner on and let it run a little bit, even during the day, turn down a couple degrees, but don't turn it off. That way we don't end up with the whole house picking up all the moisture, particularly on these that soon to come in 90% humidity days.
Mm-hmm. Sort of just sometimes even at 80, I only put it down a degree or two, you know, if the house gets that hot, you know, or whatever. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. Well, that leads to this question. Okay, so you have air conditioning, and you're going to use it, but you would also like to use it as little as possible, and so you're going to keep your bills down. So if you do say, okay, well, what I'm going to do, though, is I'm going to turn it on because of the very thing that you say, when you first turn it on, if the humidity is high and the house has been absorbing a lot of moisture, it's going to have to work. It's going to be working very hard to pump that moisture out. And it might take, you know, it could take days to really do that. So where would you suggest that you set it in relation to the outside temperature?
Well, it's going to be your own personal comfort zone. I personally am very sensitive to humidity levels. I can be in a relatively warm space as long as it's fairly dry. Likewise, I can go in a crawl space where it's 65 degrees and be sweating because of the high humidity. So the moisture level does kind of determine where your comfort zone is going to be. If you've got a house that's relatively dry, you may be comfortable in the 80-degree range. And on the really muggy day, you know, you could even get by with 82 or 83 as long as it's dry in the house. I do approve the idea of using the dehumidifiers that we've been talking about. The experimentation that I did in my own home was to run a dehumidifier on my lower level, and I was actually comfortable 2 to 3 degrees warmer on my air conditioning settings while the dehumidifier was on than if I were to unplug or disconnect the dehumidifier in order to keep the house comfortable. Like, again, I'm relatively sensitive to the humidity levels, and I would notice that even though I could take the house from 81, I'd drop it down to 78, that it wasn't necessarily as comfortable because the moisture level in the house was higher without the dehumidifier on.
Ah, so it sounds like you're saying that even though the air conditioning does, as you said before, primarily one of the things that is doing it, it's not so much it's pumping out cold air. Yeah, it is. But it's also taking humidity out of the air. It sounds like you're saying, though, even if you have central air, it might benefit you to, and if you do have dampness issues, to go ahead and actually, in addition to running the air conditioning, run the dehumidifier.
They will work in conjunction, yes. I mean, the air conditioner is probably a little bit more efficient dehumidification system, mm-hmm. but likewise, it only works when it's running. And if you've got it set on a fairly warm temperature and it's not running on a regular basis, then it's not pulling moisture out. So it could use the help of a dehumidification system that would run more constant. On a hot, humid day, it is not uncommon to get 3, 4, 5 gallons of water a day out of the house. So now you run this thing for a day or two on the hot, muggy days, and the first time we get a little bit of a temperature swing, and everybody goes and runs and opens up the windows, and it's still 80% humidity outside, and all that moisture, you can almost see it pouring into the house. So then all of a sudden the house is hot and sticky again, and you got to turn the air conditioner back on. It's why I tend to run my system. Once I turn it on, I pretty much keep it on. I may not keep it as cold as, you know, don't keep it like ice, but keep it on enough to keep the moisture levels in the house.
Yeah,
down.
And I know that that's what your dad has been saying all these years. And I guess it's, you know, you can take that advice and do with it what you like, because it is indeed very tempting after you've had a hot period of time and the house has been all closed up to say, once it gets to feel sort of tolerable outside, what you'd like to have is some fresh air. You'd like to open the place up. But that is what happens. You are then letting in a lot of moisture that you have been pumping out with your AC, and then the next time it gets hot and humid enough so that you decide, okay, I'm going to have to close things up and turn on the air conditioning again, they're going to have to then pump all that moisture back out that you have let in by opening up the windows. So I guess people can do whatever they want, but they need to, you know, they might want to keep that in mind.
Yeah. You keep in mind that if you, by fluctuating it that much, you're not necessarily going to control the humidity level in the house as adequately. And one of my favorite stories is with a friend of mine who called me up all excited that he put it in his own heating and air conditioning system. He had never had air conditioning in his house and put it in the basement. And one of the questions I asked him is, where did you run the condensate? He said, I just put a garbage can down there and it's just draining into that. And every couple of days, I'm going to go down and empty the garbage can. Well, I get a call 3 days later. Scott, how do I get this garbage can full of water out of my basement? It had collected enough water in 3 days that the can was no longer able to be lifted up and out of the basement. I'm like, well, this is where you go and invest in a sump pump and put it in your garbage can and start pumping the water back out.
That is, so, you've got to have some place to put that water that it squeezes out of the air, because, as you say, it does. It's a significant amount of water.
It's amazing how much water will come out of it. Yeah. I've done some commercial inspections where we had two furnaces back to back to do a fairly large area, and they literally had a sump pump strictly for the condensate. They didn't even, you know, you can get by on a residential usually with a small condensate pump, which is obviously designed for the condensate from an air conditioner or furnace system. It's about a size of a small shoebox, and it's got a little float switch in it, and it pumps it out through a plastic line, which you can take to a drain just about anywhere. But they, because the amount of moisture that they were pulling out of this commercial building, they actually needed a sump pump to handle the condensate. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's amazing how much moisture we can get out of it.
All right. Well, we're a bit past the midpoint here. Scott Spies is the guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is here on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday, and he is here to answer your questions about home maintenance. So if you have a problem and you're not quite sure how to deal with it, call us, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. While we're on the subject of dehumidifiers, anything in particular that you'd say when if you're going to go out and buy one that you would suggest people think about?
A dehumidifier of about any size is going to be beneficial. If you've got a huge area, then you may want to get a little bit larger one. But for the most part, just about any dehumidification unit will be beneficial. So, no, in my opinion, there's not a lot of sizing to it. It kind of depends on how much you're going to run it. Most of them come in a fairly general size. They hold a couple pints of water, and they have the equivalent of, say, about a quarter-ton air conditioner unit or a small refrigerator unit where it would produced. They still measure them in tons of ice that they would produce.
Really?
So kind of an antiquated measurement on the cooling capacities. But
Okay. And unless you want to, every time that it fills up, have to remove that bucket and take it somewhere to dump it out, you might also think, well, can I put this someplace where I can have a drain or something where I can drain the water that comes off of it?
Yeah, most of the time when you buy one of the units, it has a bucket, and the bucket will usually have a threaded end, which will happen to meet up to your common daily garden hose. Mm-hmm. You can put it over the top of a drain and just take the cap off of it, or you can set it on a shelf over a laundry sink and have the drain go down into a laundry sink. There's nothing that says it has to be in the lowest portion of the house, so any place where that drain is convenient, that dehumidifier can be installed.
All right. Well, now we have a number of callers here. We'll start in with line one. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Got another moisture question for you. I live in a single-story house built in 1959. The exterior is stone, like a flagstone kind of thing, with a white rubber roof. And I am getting moisture condensation on my windows in the wintertime. And I've talked to all kinds of different people about it, and everybody has a different answer for me. But one of the things about this house that I don't understand is there's only one crawl space vent. And I was wondering if you thought that adding further crawl space ventilation would help the moisture problem on the windows in the winter.
Probably not. My big first question would be, is there a vapor barrier in the crawl space, a sheet of plastic over the top of the soil?
Yes, there is. I put one in when we moved in. There was not previously. And before we installed that vapor barrier, it was like a greenhouse. And,
yeah, I can believe that.
Helped a lot, but it hasn't solved the problem.
Well, as long as the vapor barrier is in place and the moisture is under the vapor barrier, the moisture coming out of the soil is under the vapor barrier, ventilation of the crawl space doesn't help much, because if the water's not getting on top of the plastic or getting above the plastic, then ventilating that space is not going to be a big issue. I guess next question would be, what kind of windows do you have? Do they have a storm panel on them, or are they a double-glazed window?
It's a double pane. They're the crank out kind that were common back in the late 50s.
Okay, so some casement windows.
Yeah.
If it's a double pane window and you've got moisture on it, then yes, you have a moisture source someplace. Something is putting moisture in the house. There are several different places where it can come from. Obviously, the first one that I always jump on is the crawl space, because that the exposed soil level in a crawl space evaporates a large quantity of moisture. If you've got a vapor barrier down and the vapor barrier is in good condition and that's no longer the problem, then we need to start looking for other sources. And some of them get kind of tricky, and some of them can actually be of health issues. Water heaters and furnaces. If a water heater or furnace does not draft properly, we can be getting a lot of moisture in the house. So that's something else you want to take a look at. Is the flue system for the water heater and furnace running properly?
Okay.
A crack in a heat exchanger, in extreme cases, it's not a common thing, but in extreme cases, you can get that carbon monoxide and also some moisture back into the house. So checking the furnace system.
Okay.
It wouldn't hurt to install a timer on the bathroom fan, so when you take a shower, you can turn the timer on to, say, 30 minutes and draw the moisture out of the house after the shower.
Right. Actually, I've done that already.
Okay. And a vent hood or a range hood over the top of your cooking appliances, so the steam and moisture from cooking gets vented to the outside.
Yep.
Okay. And if those aren't issues, then there aren't the problem, then we need to start looking for possible plumbing leaks, a drain that might be dripping a little bit someplace where you can't see it, and it's actually keeping some wood wet that's then evaporating. I've actually found a plumbing pipe seeping in a wall where the water was running down the pipe and it was evaporating off the pipe, so it really wasn't leaving any water anyplace, but that was creating enough of a humidity problem to keep the house damp.
Okay.
So, I mean, basically, if you've got double glazed glass, two panes of glass, and a good vapor in the crawl space, we need to spend some time figuring out where that water's coming from.
Okay. All righty. Thank you for your help.
All right. Very good. Next is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a quick question about the dehumidifier on the air central air.
Uh-huh.
If you just leave the fan on, but don't have the cooling part on, is that taking moisture out of the air?
Actually, it does the exact opposite. When the air conditioner unit is operating and running, the outdoor compressor is running, the condenser is cold, we're moving this warm, humid air from the house past this cold coil, and the water condenses on it. When everything shuts off, if you continue to move the fan air on, I leave the fan in the on position instead of the auto position, it will actually re-evaporate some of that water that's on that coil and put it back in the house. So actually, I don't recommend leaving the fan in the on position during the cooling season, because it will actually re-evaporate some of the moisture that the air conditioner just pulled out of the air and put it back in the house. So the only time that it's actually pulling moisture out is when the outdoor compressor is cooling the coil inside the furnace.
All right. Okay, thanks.
All right, very good. And let's go to line number four next, I believe. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We are in a 20-year-old house we purchased last year, so we've had almost a full year of heating and cooling. We have the original furnace, but I'm wondering, is there any? How do I find a home energy auditor? How do I know who is qualified to help us find leaks and give us guidance about the best system to replace the furnace so we get heat and cooling to the room, all the rooms in the house?
Well, I know at one point in time there was a energy audit program out there, and I actually went through it. I don't know exactly where it's gone from there. I haven't heard much about it. Most of the time it's just some common sense walking through there and seeing what somebody with a little bit of experience, and it can be a heating and cooling guy. It could be a home inspector type person. At one time, I think the power company was doing something like that, but I think they discontinued that several years back. That's something I'm not sure I have a good answer for.
I've seen it in some of the, various home remodeling applications, and you should get a home energy auditor, but there's never any explanation of how to find such a person. We did have a home inspection, but it wasn't helpful in terms of, I know we're losing, we're using more energy than we should. We're losing a lot of our heating and cooling. We just don't know where to start.
Well, usually if you get a home inspector to come through and do a maintenance or a check on something like that, they obviously don't charge a full fee. They come by and give you an idea of what kind of things they might suggest, where to look for some of the leaks. I used to have access to a FLIR camera, which would an infrared color spectrometer that would show me where heat loss was, but that was some property of the university that my father had access to when he was working there. After retiring, we didn't have access to that any longer, and I don't know of anybody that's running something like that. There's blower doors that they can use where they can pressurize a house and see where the air leaks are. So there's a number of different ways of determining where the energy is going to. You might have to call over the office, and we'll have to work on this one and see if we can figure out who we can recommend for something like that.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, thanks. And line number three is next. I think this is I'm not sure where it is. Go ahead.
On campus.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
All right. Good morning.
Yes.
We're going to be siding our house soon. It's the house has composite siding on it, and we're going to yank that all off. It's starting to just show its age, especially around the bottoms. I'm going to take advantage of the time to increase the insulation on the house. I was thinking about just having them put sheet insulation on, but the people that I've talked to about doing the siding say that by the time you put the sheet insulation on and do the house wrap, that you know you're going to bulk out, so your windows are going to look like they're recessed. So if you're going to take a house down, take the siding down like that, how would you recommend increasing the insulation in the walls?
Kind of depends on what type of insulation is already in the walls.
Minimal.
Because if there's a bat type of insulation already in there, then it's very difficult to make to blow in or add any to it because it tends to block everything. Some of the houses that have an R7 bat or a 2-inch bat, if you really wanted to do much with it, then the best thing is when you re-side it to pull the sheathing and put new fiberglass insulation in the walls and put new sheathing on, a new insulated sheathing. The house wrap is going to help out quite a bit. Your siding guys are absolutely correct. Once you start putting a thick foam board on there, say even a half inch or 1 inch foam board, it does kind of recess the windows. It does make it a little bit more difficult to do the trimming. It also makes the flashings a little bit more complicated to help keep water from getting in behind the foam board. But if you've got some insulation, what we're trying to do with insulation, what insulation does is trap air. Air is actually your insulator. So if we can keep air from moving, then that space does not transfer heat as quickly. So that is your insulation layer. So by putting the house wrap on, even over the top of your existing sheathing, the house wrap does not allow the air to move through there. The house wrap is not a vapor barrier. It does allow moisture to move through. A water vapor will move through it.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily liquid water, but as a vapor, it will.
Sure.
So a thin foam board will help a little bit, but probably your house wrap is going to be your biggest issue or your biggest help, because what it's going to do is it's going to let the insulation you already have in the walls not get as much air moving through it, so you will have a higher insulating value just from the house wrap.
Okay, so when they take that old siding off, there's going to be sheathing there over the frame of the house.
And that's correct. There will be some type of sheathing, my guess. Well, depending on when the house is built, sometimes it's a plywood sheathing. Sometimes it's a home soap board or what they call a fiber board. Other times when we were building in the mid-90s, nothing but styrofoam. They actually put a 1-inch or a 3/4-inch foam board right directly on the sheathing.
This was early 70s, 73, I believe, is when it was.
Yeah,
built.
So it's probably what I'll call a home soap board or a fiber board, which had a low insulating value, but it will increase greatly as soon as we stop moving air through it by putting the house wrap around it.
The sheathing, would that just be a thin plywood?
Plywood was something that was also used. The stuff I'm referring to, if you're built in the 70s, you probably – it's like a half an inch thick of I hate to say good grade cardboard, but it looks like a bunch of wood fibers glued back together.
The heavy black stuff.
Like correct. That. Right.
Okay. I'm just wondering, you know, how we can maybe peek in there and see just what's left of the insulation on the walls to see if it would be necessary to pull the sheathing off and put in new bat insulation and then put the sheathing back. Is there any way how would you test without, doing a lot of destruction to the existing sheathing?
Well, you can most likely there'll be a hole or two in the sheathing you can look in behind. If not, there are 4x8 panels, so it wouldn't be that difficult to pull one back and take a look. Now, of course, if it's a blown-in insulation, everything's going to want to fall out from behind it. So you start at the top and work your way down.
Okay. All righty. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good. We have about 5 minutes left with our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we do every month. Talk about home maintenance and questions are welcome. We'll do as many as we can. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Up next, I believe, is Loda. Someone in Loda. Line 4. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have a question about gutters. I just tuned in, so I don't know if you've already talked about gutters, but I've been reading a little bit about foam leaf guards, and particularly the Gutter Stuff brand. Do you have any experience with those products?
There are several different types of gutter guards, and all of them are trying to help reduce the amount of debris that get into the gutters. And most of them work to some degree. Some obviously work better than others. One of the things I have found is that you want to get one that is not all that difficult to take off, because no matter how much stuff they are trying to keep out, something will always get in there, and you need to be able to clean it out once in a while. And some of the ones they're installing, it's almost impossible to clean the gutters once they do block up. So I like to recommend something that is removable. The foam ones work well. The mesh ones work well. There's even some that go over the top and use the thin film effect where the water rolls back over the gutter. They actually completely cover the gutter. Different brands will need to have the gutters cleaned more often. Obviously, the finer it is, the more stuff it tries to keep out, then the longer the gutters will stay clean. But usually those are the ones that are most difficult to get in and clean the gutters once they do block up.
Mm-hmm.
I have used the foam ones on mine. I've also used the screen mesh ones on several different properties, and they seem to work well. You just have to remember that it's not a cure-all. You still need to get up there every once in a while, but hopefully it's not two or three times a year. Usually once a year we'll take care of it.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
All right, very good. Back here to someone on our line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I have been in a house for more than 20 years, and we have one of those old-fashioned solar systems on the roof with the louvers, and we have had it repaired several times, but the last time we did, we talked about removing it because it is a very old system, but I didn't know if I should have my plumbing and heating people in at the same time. And I don't know where to start with solar people because there's I don't know who to use this time. And there's a matter of capping off the connections to the furnace and the hot water heater down in the basement. So it's a complicated thing. And my normal, reliable plumbers don't want to get near it because they don't know anything about it.
Okay, I can understand that. Solar energy is one of those things where it's a great idea. It doesn't seem to work really well in central Illinois at this point because we just don't have enough sunlight. The atmosphere filters out too much of the energy. And you get up in Colorado or in places like that up in the mountains, you have a lot more solar gain. It works a lot better than it does here. It does help somewhat. But as the systems do get older, they do lose a lot of their efficiency, and they can be more expensive to maintain than what they're actually helping.
Mm-hmm.
I can believe that it's going to be a trick to get a plumber that can help take care of that. I probably have one or two people that I could recommend if you wanted to call over to the office at a later time.
Okay, great.
Because I've got some guys that specialize in some custom plumbing work, heating, cooling, et cetera.
Okay, so you don't think I should try to get in touch with the original people that did the solar repair? This is something that any plumbing and heating people could do because, there's wiring that goes from the attic to the basement that goes along with that system, too.
Well, it's not a bad idea to check with the original installer if they're still around.
I don't know if they still are. That's why I need names of, I don't know if the new people in the solar business would know enough about this old stuff to either take it out or repair it.
Well, unfortunately, there's no good way of telling which company is going to have somebody that has that particular knowledge. So you may have to get one or two people to come out and give you some estimates and pick the one that seems, I used to install those.
Okay, so, yeah.
But my guess is...
I'm having trouble getting started with my research because I'm assuming that those original people may not be in business any longer. They were from Peoria.
Okay. Well, I would check with it. And like I say, if you get a couple of people come out there and haven't found somebody that you feel that understood the system enough to figure out how to disassemble it, give us a call over at the office and I can probably come up with one or two names that will most likely
Thank
give you a hand.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right.
It.
We'll get Bye-bye. One more here at least. Caller line two. Hello.
Hello, yeah. My
yes.
name is David Burlingame, and I heard that you were just talking about, you know, energy auditing and weatherization of homes. And yeah, I'm just about prepared to get into the business of doing energy audits. I'm just waiting to get my BPI certification finalized. And I just wanted to make a mention that, yeah, I know, I mean, the reason I got into this is because there's nobody in town who is able to provide those services.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's going to, I think it's going to start taking off a little bit more. We have done a little bit of it as part of my home inspection. I don't necessarily do a full energy audit as far as mapping out all the air losses and stuff, but I do walk through them and kind of give a general idea. So, yeah, I think that is a niche that would be a good thing here in town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Am I online? Or
yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
Well, I'm really excited about getting into this field. And, like, you know, I have the infrared camera and I have the blower door and the dust blaster. Like I said, I'm just waiting to get my finalized, you know, certification from BPI. And I'm also working on the ResNet certification. But, yeah, I can be contacted or I can be found online at burlingameinspectors.com.
Okay, well, thank you for letting us know that that is available here in the area.
All right, very good. Well, and I think it would not surprise me, as you said, if in the future there'll be more people offering the service because there's going to be more and more demand. I mean, obviously there is demand right now. There are people who would be happy to hire somebody to do it if they could find the person to do it.
I've been getting a few phone calls on it and, like I say, doing some cursory checks on things like that. But one of the things that has prevented me from getting into it immediately is the high cost of some of the electronic equipment, such as the infrared camera. They are getting much more affordable now, but when I first started looking at them, they're at $18,000. It's like, well, I don't know if I can afford to. And, of course, you had to have a small van to carry it around in. Now we can get some handheld ones that will work. So, yeah, I think it's something that's going to come around.
All right. There we got to leave it for this time around. Our guest, Scott Spies, is a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here once a month, always on a Monday, to talk about home maintenance. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.